From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capitol Notes Podcast, our weekly look at politics and state government and public policy and Christmas shopping and menorah lightings. And
everything. Sixth night. Seventh night.
For those, right, exactly, since this doesn't come out till Friday morning.
Right.
Anthony, Thursday afternoon taping.
Well, then Friday would be the eighth night. I think I've lost track.
Okay.
I think Friday's the eighth night, eighth and final.
Details seem to be not your forte in this podcast, right?
Oh, right, as Richard Pan well knows. Although, I think that was you that botched that one. Well, it was a combo botch, I think.
First of all, that's Anthony York, the editor of Capitol Weekly, who's trying to decide who botched it last week. And I'm John Myers from KQED Public Radio. And Anthony's referring to a correction or an apology. Go ahead, Anthony.
To the candidate in the fifth, a Democrat running in the 5th Assembly District, Dr. Richard Pan, who I think we called Fred Pan, who's a guy I went to high school with.
I did not call him that.
Well, no, but you had somebody else running in the district who's actually
running. But then that was Dr. Let's not go down that whole path again, because it'll just open the floodgates of problems.
Point is, we goofed. We got it wrong. Anyway. But it was a birthday present from me to Dr. Pan's political consultant, who had his birthday last week.
Oh, who's that?
Mr. Josh Pulliam, Democratic political consultant extraordinaire.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
All right, so now that we have cleaned
up. And happy Hanukkah to Josh, too.
Now that we've tried to clean up the mess from last week, why don't we try to move forward and see what kind of mess we can make for this week?
I don't think we did a very good job cleaning up the mess.
No, not so much.
No.
So we're going to start off with the poll that came out this week, the new statewide poll that if you're a good political junkie listening to the podcast, you can chew on a little bit. From the Public Policy Institute of California, we'll put a link on the page for it, so if you haven't read it yet. A lot of stuff in the PPIC poll. I mean, there's a lot of stuff on the president in Afghanistan, and let's don't go there. Let's just do all the fun stuff of the race for governor in 2010. First of all, the incumbent governor, lowest approval rating ever for PPIC, 27%.
3%, right?
Yeah, times nine. 27%. And the legislature, still stellar. At 17%.
I think that's up from the last.
I think that's flat.
Yes.
Flatlining. But the race for governor next year, there were some new numbers, and I think it's worth talking about a little bit. First of all, on the Republican side, where you have three candidates, Meg Whitman, Steve Poizner, Tom Campbell, you know them now. They're all household names by now. Apparently not, according to the poll.
Depends on the household.
Exactly. The poll shows a lot of people still not dialed into this race, and that's really the real thing, is that people aren't really dialed in yet. But for those who are, Whitman 32%, Campbell 12%, Poizner 8%. What do you make of that, Anthony York?
First of all, it's worth pointing out that these numbers mirror very closely the numbers in the recent Capitol Weekly Pulitzer Research poll.
That's
not really what we're going for here.
Still a lot of undecideds, fair
enough.
Right,
a lot of undecideds, and Meg Whitman is the only one advertising in the race now. We're still a little less than, 7 months away from the primary? 6 months away. It's June, whatever. My calendar math isn't so good. But I think that the poll at this stage is still a test of name identification. Meg Whitman was on the radio with ads, and she's given $19 million to her own account. They'll say they haven't spent it all yet. But she's been on the air trying to get her name ID up, and I think that it's working. Now, we saw this week that the insurance commissioner, Steve Poizner, who is no financial slouch himself, has promised to write himself a check for $15 million. We'll see if and when that happens, and if Poizner gets on the air early next year, and if that moves the poll numbers at all.
All that being said, I mean, the Poizner campaign, this poll unfortunately plays into a narrative they're trying to push back against, which is that Poizner's not in the race. And again, it is very early, so you can't say he's not. You can't say he can't compete. But they have, it's a narrative that's out there that you read a lot about where is Steve Poizner, what's going on, why isn't his operation firing on more cylinders at this point? And, 32-8 is a pretty big gap, even this early and even with a lot of undecideds. And yes, Whitman has put the money out there, but that's a lot. And Campbell, I don't know where Tom Campbell, who's the least wealthy guy probably personally of all of these in there. Don't know how Campbell feels about it. I mean, he's still in second place. But
great. What do you get for that?
What do you get for second place? I don't think anything when it comes to politics. The other side of the ledger in this poll, though, is what I focused on in a blog posting I wrote about, and I still think it's one of the most fascinating parts, mm-hmm. and that's Jerry Brown.
Yep.
Jerry Brown, not the declared candidate, still not declared, exploring the race, but there's nobody else running for the Democratic nomination. Brown beat, in hypothetical matchups, beat all three, Whitman, Campbell, and Poizner.
But
in the Brown-Whitman matchup, Brown was only up by 6 points. It was only a six-point lead for Brown with 20% undecided, so absolutely important to note, 20% undecided. But for a guy with four decades of political experience versus someone who's been on the scene less than a year, very interesting. And also, when you dig down deeper, the favorable unfavorables on Brown, 35 favorable, 36 unfavorable against, that's the whole sample. 29% of Democrats had no opinion or said they didn't have enough information on Jerry Brown to have an opinion about him. 29% on Jerry Brown.
Yeah. I mean, I think that...
Whose first run for office in L.A. was in 1969.
Did you look that up for your blog post?
Yeah.
And first run for statewide office was?
Secretary of State.
In 1970, right? Elected governor in 74.
Right.
And then reelected in 78.
Thank you.
Ran for president in 1980, lost. Ran for U.S. Senate in 1982, lost. Anyway.
This is your
Mayor
life.
Oakland.
This is your life, Jerry Brown.
But point being that that there are a lot of – there's a generation of voters now who don't know Jerry Brown. I think Jerry Brown has forced the issue, moving candidates out of the race, frozen a lot of fundraising on the Democratic side because there was an inevitability about his candidacy. That might be true for the Democratic primary. It's not true statewide. I mean, Brown's in this state, his father was governor, his sister ran for governor. Brown's in this state do not lose Democratic primaries. That is a proven fact. They have a much...
well, it'd be impossible to lose it if you didn't have a challenger right now.
Well, but they've had challengers in the past,
right.
And Browns have always won their Democratic primaries. In general elections, the Brown family has a much more mixed record. Kathleen Brown got crushed by Pete Wilson in 1994. Pat Brown lost to Ronald Reagan. Jerry Brown, you know, lost in 1980 when he ran for president. Lost again to Pete Wilson in 1982. Lost California to Bill Clinton when he ran for president in 1992. That was not a general election, but point being that that Jerry Brown has some work to do, and he still doesn't have a campaign operation in place. I think that there are some Democrats who are nervous. I think if you
and the poll can't help that.
No, it can't help. And you know, there's an assumption out there. This being California, and you look at our statewide elected officials. We only have two Republicans in statewide office. We have close to two-thirds majority in both legislative houses are controlled by Democrats. And there's a sense that Republicans can't win here. And I don't think that's true. I mean, I think that the right Republican candidate, and especially if you sort of look ahead and imagine what the atmospherics may be by the time November 2010 comes around, I think a lot of folks in a generic way assume it's going to be a tough year for Democrats. And so you can see the storm clouds lining up here for Brown backers and for people who want Jerry Brown to be the next governor. And I think it's pretty easy to envision a scenario where Meg Whitman could actually win this thing.
Well,
I'll give
the Brown camp their moment here. Steve Glazer, who's a spokesman, a campaign spokesman for Jerry Brown, called me up to make sure that the Brown camp got their point in after I wrote that, you know, maybe Jerry Brown should be measuring the drapes for the governor's office again, and said that they've never considered themselves the front runner, always considered this to be a competitive race. Maybe, but I don't think there's anyone who thinks that Jerry Brown wouldn't be the front runner, given he's Jerry Brown in a general election for governor against Republicans who don't have the name ID that Jerry Brown has.
And
I was just going to say quickly, so that was their one point. And the other point is when you hear about voters not being happy with their choices, and Democrats not even being happy with their choice, singular.
Undeclared choice.
Yeah, I think, Steve Glazer's point was that, you know, well, voters are never happy with their choices. They never say they're absolutely thrilled with their choices. So, in other words, trying to kind of, you know, devalue that part of it. But again, I just don't know how Jerry Brown couldn't be the front runner. I don't know how he couldn't be, given his persona, his name ID, who he's known as.
Right.
And again, you know, what Jerry Brown would be running, because there have been lots of incarnations of,
well, look,
of,
he,
of him.
He's had the job before. I mean, he's got it. And I think part of the problem that the Brown campaign is going to have to deal with is managing expectations, is that expectation
which
in the media.
Which would explain my conversation.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, it's a little disingenuous, I think, for the Brown camp to say they don't think they're the front runner. I mean, that tactically that might be true, but I think that's also part of a campaign to try to manage those expectations. And look, it's going to be a close race regardless. You know, more likely than not, and it's going to be a hard-fought campaign. Certainly Whitman or Poizner or perhaps even a Campbell would likely – the Republican nominee will have the resources to wage a fight here. We can talk about Campbell and his resources if you'd like to. But that – I think any perceived sign of weakness is sort of a double strike for Jerry Brown because – there was an assumption among the sort of intelligentsia here in Sacramento, if it's not a paradox.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, an oxymoron.
Yeah, that he would sort of waltz into the governor's office. And clearly that doesn't appear like it's going to be the case.
Well, there are two other things that PPIC poll asked about that I think are worth noting. They asked voters, what's more important when you're looking for a candidate for governor, someone who has elective office experience or someone who has experience running a business? 32% of those surveyed said elected office is important. 50% said running a business. Theoretically, advantage Meg Whitman there because outsider business experience, all the things that people say is wrong with government and government operations.
Right.
The other one was flip for Whitman Brown here. I say, in other words, that one was advantage Whitman. Let's call it mm-hmm. that. The other question was, what's more important, a candidate who raises cash from their supporters or a candidate who spends their own money? Which would you prefer? 49% said, I want somebody who raises cash from supporters. 39% said, spend your own money. Advantage Brown, possibly in the, I'm buying the seed, I'm spending $150 million, you know, billionaire, right. former CEO of eBay. Now, none of that necessarily means everything yet. These are just morsels to ruminate over as you enjoy the holidays. I don't know.
Ruminate, is that with an H? Or H E U.
But I see themes that you can see these camps, assuming it's Brown, Whitman, again, careful, Poizner, Campbell, not out of the race. But even if they're there, I see themes that people could explore, that campaigns could explore in 2010.
Potentially, although this isn't new stuff. I mean,
it's not new.
I point you to Governor Al Checky or Senator Michael Huffington. You know, for those who
I interviewed both of them last week.
Yeah, but
they're both on a beach in Bermuda.
Don't say together, because remember, Huffington did come out as gay, Myers. Well, you said they were both.
Wasn't even going there, but thank you.
I was, anyway, we'll discuss this later.
You might want to delete that part of the podcast. Go ahead.
But point being that in a generic sense, you know, business experience might be more desirable than political experience. But I don't know that that's necessarily true. When voters are in the polls. I mean, remember the 1998 campaign, you know, Gray Davis's campaign slogan, experience money can't buy. I mean, these things sort of vacillate on the political pendulum here. Do they vacillate? They swing, I guess, on the pendulum. So, you know, and look at what's going on in Delaware right now. There's a big trial going on, Craigslist, eBay.
Where
trial.
Whitman's had to testify, and also
right.
the now somewhat infamous YouTube video of the guy from Craigslist saying that there was an evil Meg.
Evil. There are two Megs.
Yeah, there are two Megs, the good Meg and the evil Meg.
Right.
And
so,
you'll see that again.
And
anyway.
Point being that business experience in the abstract is one thing. Drilling down into the record is going to be another. I mean, I think you're going to see this a lot in the U.S. Senate race, both in the primary and if Carly Fiorina is the Republican nominee. I mean, her record at HP is going to be out front, and I don't think that business experience might be one thing, but if you start getting into Fiorina's tenure at HP and the layoffs and what happened at the company while she was there, and you know, all the stories that have and will be written, it's a different thing entirely.
Well, two other things I would say, and we can move off the topic, but one is I spend a lot of time looking at decline to state voters in these polls, and I think you really can't underestimate these independent voters. They are 1 in 5 of voters. They kind of cross the spectrum, I think, in terms of what they're more to the left and more to the right on. And they were Schwarzenegger voters. They were supportive of the recall. You know, where they're going to play out in this, I think, is going to be interesting, because both campaigns are going to have to appeal to them, especially the Republican nominee, whoever he or she might be, because they're the minority party in the state.
38% registered Republicans.
Yeah, they've got to have declined to state voters. They're not going to go get diehard Democrats, I don't think, in most cases. And the other thing is who shows up at the polls in November 2010, because, you know, there was at least a little bit of discussion online after this poll came out about the sampling that PPIC had done and their assumptions as to who would turn out in a general election. Some people think that the electorate could be a little older in November 2010 than PPIC thought, although I would say it's a long ways away, so nobody knows. What will happen to all the young voters from 2008? Will they show back up? Will they not show up?
They're all going to be voting on the legalization of marijuana.
Bingo, Anthony York. Well, no, but that's only so much of a joke, because if something like that gets on the ballot that motivates a generational block who see an issue differently, and legalization of pot might be it. I mean, maybe it's something else. Who knows? What happens then when you have a younger electorate? Again, if you're Jerry Brown, there's a generational issue there. Who knows?
And it's not just a generational issue. I mean, I think that the rest of the ballot is a valid thing to consider here. I mean, we've got initiatives circulating right now that that could be aimed at public employee pensions.
Back in North Carolina, we say we have a passel of initiatives circulating right now. Yeah, passel. So describe them.
Is that a metric? Is that a metric measurement?
That's a passel.
A passel.
Y'all.
Is that like a passel tax?
Go ahead.
Okay.
You've got public employee, okay. Please. I derailed you.
Yes. I got off my passel there. But there's a pension initiative that could be headed to the ballot, the so-called Paycheck Protection Initiative.
Would refight that fight.
Yeah. And so those
also
things,
corporate contributions, which is the retribution side from the left on that about campaign money.
But there are initiatives out there that could energize the base of one party or another, which could alter the makeup of the electorate.
We're not even sure that we're avoiding the redo of the same-sex marriage fight. I mean, there are still people in the gay rights community who want to fight that one again next year. So all of those, I mean, great examples of how it can influence who turns out. And then also the candidates have to react to those.
Right.
You know, it's not like in so many – I remember, you know, thinking about back to last November, thinking about President Obama, I would argue, dancing around the issue of the gay marriage issue in California, you know, and maybe even during the primary, too, he was asked and the others were asked. But you remember this? It was kind of a dance, I would say, of not really wanting to tick off anybody in that. Mm-hmm. That's a lot easier when you're a national candidate and it's one state. You can't do that when you're running for governor.
No.
And it's every issue on the ballot. What about spending this, doing that, legislating this?
Right. So. And all the political reform stuff that's out there. I mean, you know, it's a very strange time economically and politically still right now. And I think that, hey, it's a long way till November. Can we end it with a cliche?
We can. Okay. It's a long way to November. So our second topic is the
Segway.
Proprietary investigatory, analytical, not really investigatory.
Highly scientific.
Highly dubious
yes,
rankings.
Yes.
Of Capital Weekly's legislative scorecard for the year. Who's a lefty? Who's a righty? Not how they pick up their pen. Yeah. Who's lib? Who's conservative? Who's whatever out of 120 lawmakers? Mm-hmm. Anthony, who's where and why?
Yeah. And it's – look, this is not necessarily – I mean, even terms like liberal and conservative are sort of
– Backpedal.
It says in the
disclaimer.
Text, in the disclaimer itself, that you can find on capitalweekly.net.
Capital with an O.
Yes. Thank you. I mean, we tried to pick some interesting votes that didn't necessarily fit easily into one category or another. And so – yeah, we ended up with some interesting results, a couple of little surprises, but I think by and large, no real shockers on our scorecard.
All right, so assuming, and we can talk about maybe quickly in a moment some of the bills you picked,
mm-hmm.
but let's do the big news. So who did you find consistently on the left side of the political spectrum?
We found a number of legislators with sort of perfect liberal rankings, names that if these names are familiar to you, none of them are a surprise. Tom Amiano from San Francisco, Julia Brownlee from Santa Monica, Mike Fuhr from Los Angeles, Jared Huffman from San Rafael, Bonnie Lowenthal from Long Beach, Bill Monning from Santa Cruz. I mean, a lot of you know, liberal members
even
of the Assembly.
Even if you just took where they're from, San Francisco, South Bay area, parts of L.A., you're not terribly surprised.
On the Senate side, Lonnie Hancock from Berkeley, Christine Kehoe from San Diego, Mark Leno, San Francisco, Alan Lowenthal, the ex-husband of Bonnie Lowenthal. They got matching scores. Isn't that quaint?
I don't know how to read that one.
Fran Pavley from Santa Monica. Right?
Yes. I mean, and on the right side, on the conservative side of the spectrum, you found
some familiar names, and some had some problems because we did not include, which, you know, all things considered, we probably should have included the vote. We had some budget votes on there. We didn't have the big tax increase vote from what was that, February? That cost Mike Vallines his leadership. Mike Vallines received the top conservative score on our card from our bills.
Which is probably why you get a Republican phone call saying, how can he be the most conservative,
I don't know about a Republican phone call. I've got several.
Several.
But other names on there, Jim Silva, Steve Knight, Joel Anderson on the Assembly. In the Senate, you have Sam Onestad from Grass Valley, who's running for lieutenant governor. George Runner, who's from the Inland Empire, the High Desert,
yes.
Palmdale, Lancaster, who's running for Board of Equalization. Interestingly, perhaps Dave Cogdill, the former, again, someone who
lost his leadership position in the Senate.
So clearly, if we had had that tax increase vote, they would not have scored quite as high or low on the scale, depending on your perspective.
Any moderates left in the legislature, according to your analysis, Mr. York?
Yeah, there were actually quite a few. And again, no real surprises.
Wait, there are quite a few. Which would go against the conventional wisdom that there are none.
Three or four in each house.
Okay. So 6 or 8 out of 120.
Perhaps.
Okay, maybe the conventional wisdom is right about no moderates.
But folks like Abel Maldonado, the lieutenant governor select, is that what we're calling him?
Designee.
Gloria Negrete McLeod from San Bernardino County, Lou Correa from Orange County. The Democrats who sort of received some moderate scores.
Are there any Republicans who got moderate
scores?
Well,
Abel Maldonado.
Yeah, Maldonado, right.
On the Republican side, or on the Assembly side, Allison Huber from El Dorado, Kathleen Galgiani from somewhere down there in the Central Valley. The Charles Calderon. Not a whole lot of moderates, but again, for people who monitor the workings of the House is not a whole lot of real surprises.
But again, and I don't want to, I don't want to be criticized as a reporter who's trying to read too much into that. But of all the names you just read out, you only read out one Republican, Abel Maldonado,
and only five Democrats.
But there were no other Republicans who scored in the moderate thing from what you read out. Maybe you missed a couple there, one or two.
No, I don't think I did.
And the Democrats who you read out, get the reputation as moderate because they tend to vote more pro-business pro-economic policies.
And that's a lot of what this scorecard
But on other issues, I would not call them necessarily moderate.
Right. There were not a lot of social issues that came up. In part because I think the legislature tried to steer away from a lot of the social issues this year. We did include the vote for Harvey Milk Day, which was eventually signed by the governor. But we didn't have a whole lot of social issue votes on our scorecard.
I guess what I just find fascinating about those mods, if in fact they are mods, is that they are not reliable moderates, I guess would be my point. And in most cases, and not all, but in most cases, they will vote for the leadership when push comes to shove, or leadership will get them to vote they want them to vote.
Right.
For.
And remember,
but it just goes back to the larger narrative of a gaping hole in the middle in the political spectrum in Sacramento.
There is, and some of these moderate votes might even be disingenuous because Democrats have such padded majorities in both legislative houses that they can politically afford to protect their members who are in marginal districts, people like Allison Huber, who may be able to vote with Republicans, but the bill would still pass, right? So that's a luxury that Democrats have that Republicans don't.
And it should be worth noting that one of the bills you chose for your measurements was a bill that was purged that doesn't technically exist.
Oh, but it does in the hearts and minds of Capital Weekly readers everywhere.
And actually more than that, because you sparked that story across the country.
Across the country. That might be a stretch.
But the bill in question.
Was AB 23. It was the bill to renew oil drilling off the coast of Santa Barbara.
Yeah, to allow the lease off northern Santa Barbara County, which is called Trancheon Ridge.
Yeah. The bill passed the Senate. With the bare majority, 21-18, I believe, and then came up for a vote in the assembly, was voted down, and then the vote was purged. Poof. Magic.
As though
gone.
It never happened.
And yet, we still have the vote, and we kept it handy, and we decided to be jerks and include it on our scorecard. So, yeah.
Although, in fairness, it does show a particularly... a particularly interesting way of examining left-right, because that's an issue that California's can identify with. So.
And it was interesting, that particular bill, Audra Strickland, a Republican from Santa Barbara, voted Ventura. Against it. Well, yeah, but she represents the
district. Yeah, fair enough, sorry.
But she voted against it because oil drilling is a hot-button issue on that. So her conservative score went down because that was scored as an environmental vote if you voted against the oil drilling. See how that works?
Got it. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
No,
well,
it's not.
Yeah,
don't
it, sure it is.
Me.
Come on. It's very interesting. So interesting. I'll put a link up to that, too, so everybody can read that. That'll be fun. Okay. And with that, we've got to go do our holiday shopping, so we should leave.
Uh-huh. Bye.
So for Anthony York at Capital Weekly, I'm John Myers from KQED. We'll see you next time.
Happy Hanukkah.